This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm Linda Mottram. Tonight, a sixth night of unrest across the United States. Fires and confrontation are outside the White House. Everything from peaceful protest to looting and destruction in cities from coast to coast. That's where we'll start tonight. And the reactions here? Well, relatives of Aboriginal Australians who died in custody express solidarity with the protesters in the US. PM speaks with the family of Kumanjai Walker in the Northern Territory. And a former school principal who says his complaints about a pedophile priest were ignored will sue the Catholic Archdiocese of Melbourne for compensation.
They need to readdress what they've done and look after the principal so that in the future our whistleblowers and our good people are protected rather than pedophile priests.
As America is roiled by a sixth night of protests, there are strong indications another three police could be charged over the killing of George Floyd, an unarmed black man pinned by the neck to the ground by at least one officer. Being silent is complicit, is the message from the police chief who sacked the four officers who were at the scene of the 46-year-old's death last week. The video of the moment has ignited fury about systemic police racism in the US. But the prospect of more charges being laid has not placated George Floyd's family. We'll speak to a protest organiser in a moment, but first this report from Annie Guest.
Fireworks drown out peaceful protests near the White House. Across from the White House, crowds throw stones and bottles and ignite a fire. They surge against lines of riot police with plastic shields who spray tear gas. Lights are turned off and the US president's residence and workplace goes dark. Yeah! Anger over another black death at the hands of police is compounded by fury at Donald Trump being tougher on the rioters than the cause of the riots, painting all the protests with the brush of violent radicalism amid his threats to label the black-clad anti-fascist protest group Antifa a terrorist organisation. As smoke rises near the Washington Monument, outside the White House, protesters chanted George Floyd.
George Floyd! George Floyd! George Floyd!
As protests continued for a sixth night, there have been violent confrontations in dozens of other cities, including New York, Chicago, Atlanta, Philadelphia, and Los Angeles. Streets that only days ago were deserted because of coronavirus have thronged with demonstrators marching shoulder to shoulder, many defying curfews imposed to curb arson and looting. Meanwhile, an extraordinary message came from the Minneapolis police chief, Medario Arondo.
To the Floyd family, being silent or not intervening to me, you're complicit. So I don't see a level of distinction any different.
In a mark of respect, the police chief took off his hat every time a question was asked about George Floyd.
The charging and those decisions will have to come through our county attorney's office. Certainly the FBI is investigating that. But to the Floyd family, I want you to know that my decision to fire all four officers was not based on some sort of hierarchy. Mr. Floyd died in our hands. I see that as being complicit.
The dead man's devastated brother, Philanese Floyd, responded through CNN.
They arrest guys every day. They had enough evidence to fire them, so they have enough evidence to arrest them. I don't know who he's talking to, but I need him to do it because we all are listening. Black Lives Matter.
Demonstrations have broken out in at least 75 cities, with the National Guard and curfews on a scale not seen since the aftermath of Martin Luther King's assassination in 1968. Journalists and camera crews are among the injured. In Minneapolis, one reportedly lost an eye. Another posted a photo of a rubber bullet wound to the neck. And the BBC recorded the moment police with a riot shield charged into a cameraman in Washington. Meanwhile, it's also emerged that the US Secret Service whisked Mr. Trump to the bunker, or Presidential Emergency Operations Center, during protests on Friday.
Annie Guest with that report. Well, Michael Sampson II is an organiser with the National Alliance Against Racist and Political Repression. He's in Jacksonville, Florida, one of the many, many cities that have seen protests since the death of George Floyd. He told me the killing of the unarmed 46-year-old set off a powder keg in his country.
You've had this feeling of anger bubbling for a long time. George Floyd, seeing that video and seeing the illicit and vicious way that that officer essentially choked him out, you know, had his knee on the back of his neck, and seeing that live, seeing that video, you know, that set off a powder keg in this country that is, you know, still, that fire is still burning. You know, we've had thousands of civilians in this country are killed every year by cops here. So essentially you have a law enforcement who can do whatever they want to with impunity. So when you have a people, you know, with African Americans who have faced this discrimination, this racism, you know, white supremacist laws that have targeted our community, and they see African American like George Floyd being murdered and on video, and those officers involved not charged, I think that was the last straw for a lot of folks.
Now, we have, of course, seen a third-degree murder charge laid against the one officer. We've also seen today some shifts, some changes in the way the investigation is being handled. Are you confident that the authorities will get action, will get justice?
Not at all. We've had a history. Even in Minneapolis, in the suburbs, the on-camera shooting of an African-American man, Philando Castile, and that killer officer who murdered Philando on Facebook Live, they saw him exonerated, or not even charged, I believe. So it's hard for folks to really trust the criminal justice system here in the United States, because for so long it's been a means of oppressing a lot of the African-American population here.
There's a lot of dismay and concern about the violence that we've seen in recent days. We've seen a lot of peaceful protesters, but we've also seen these flare-ups of violence. You're an organiser. How can it be that peaceful protests turn violent in this way? Who's responsible, do you think?
So, you know, we had thousands marching yesterday, and our protest we had was organised, it was peaceful. I think the issue is, and a lot of times in a lot of these areas, you know, once the organized protest is over, you have folks on the streets who still want to protest, still are angry. You know, you have a lot of angry energy out in the streets. This is not just from even just African Americans. A lot of white Americans, Asian Americans, a lot of folks are out on the streets. But then those folks are met with riot gear and tanks. So a lot of times the violence that you see is instigated from our perspective, from law enforcement.
Sure, but we do see people looting and lighting buildings and so forth. Is that something that has come from the people, you know, that have gone to the protests you've organised, or do you think that's infiltration from outside?
I think you have instigators who play a role in kind of instigating these actions, but I do think a lot of what you see is anger, frustration, and people who are just tired of seeing a government that isn't working for them here in the United States.
What do you think, you know, this is the sixth straight night, despite curfews now in many, many cities, that we're seeing people on the streets. What do you think will bring it to an end?
I think when we see, you know, accountability, you know, when we see those officers in Minneapolis who took part in the murder of George Floyd arrested. But as well, the thing that we've been saying, and I think a lot of folks have been saying, that there are cases of George Floyd in every city in the United States. While a lot of the protests you see are directly because of the video of George Floyd, it's also due to people just feeling like the police department isn't responsive to them. Isn't serving their communities, but over-policing and brutalizing and criminalizing them. You know, I think when you see that shift and that change from police departments acknowledging those failures and trying to address them, as well as, you know, the administration in D.C., but as well as, you know, local and state governments actually acknowledging these issues and wanting to address them, then I think you will see more peace. But until then, you know, it's very apparent that, you know, Trump has an agenda of law and order and sending the National Guard in all these cities you know, curfews, and you see a national coordinated strategy of sorts to kind of clamp down on all this unrest before it gets out of control. Unfortunately, it may have the opposite effect. You know, you have people who've been quarantined for months due to COVID. I saw a social media post telling that there's such a rush to reopen and open all these businesses during a pandemic, yet they're willing to do a curfew and close everything when protests for Black Lives come out. I thought that was a pretty powerful message.
Michael Sampson, thank you for speaking with us tonight.
No, appreciate it. Thank you for the opportunity.
Protest organiser Michael Sampson in Jacksonville, Florida. Well, as protests about police brutality rage across the US, Australians are being urged to look in the mirror. Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander adults make up around 2% of Australia's population, but they constitute 27% of people in prison. Since the end of the Royal Commission into Aboriginal deaths in custody in 1991, more than 400 First Nations people have died in custody here. Today, relatives of David Dungay, who died in custody in New South Wales in 2015, expressed solidarity with the family of George Floyd. And now the family of Kumanjai Walker, the young man killed only last year by Northern Territory police, have told PM they also stand with protesters in the US. Oliver Gordon reports.
In November last year, Eddie Robertson's grandson, Kumanjai Walker, was allegedly murdered by a police officer in the Central Australian community of Yuendumu. He was shot by police officer Jeremy Rolfe, who has pleaded not guilty to the charge of murder. Today, Eddie Robertson has told PM he stands with the people protesting against police brutality in the United States.
I agree with those people who are doing a march past. We have that problem here in Australia as well.
There were some protests in Yuendumu as well after Kumanjai passed away. Does that remind you of the protests in the USA?
Yeah, it really did hurt me. I think what triggered that one is a family of feeling of that other person who got killed. Or I'll say a senseless killing of a person, you know, a innocent person.
The family of Kumanjai Walker are not the only relatives drawing parallels between the killing of George Floyd in the US with their own experiences in Australia. Today, relatives of David Dungay Jr., who died in custody in New South Wales in 2015, told the ABC it was hard not to compare Dungay's death with George Floyd's, as they were saying the exact same words before they passed. I can't breathe.
I really do feel for the family over in the US because we do know how it feels to actually watch a video clip of a loved one being suffocated to death.
Dungay Jr. died in Long Bay Prison Hospital after being forcibly moved to an observation cell, restrained face down and sedated. A coronial inquest found Mr. Dungay died from cardiac arrhythmia, with contributing factors including his type 1 diabetes, antipsychotic medication and extreme stress and agitation. As protests sweep through the US, grabbing headlines around the world, there is a difference of opinion on the actions of the protesters. This morning, Prime Minister Scott Morrison spoke to Ben Fordham on 2GB Radio.
I saw a good meme on the weekend. Martin Luther King, didn't change anything by burning anything down and looting any shops. And so it was as upsetting and terrible as the murder that took place. And it is shocking. It's just that also just made me cringe. And I just think to myself, how wonderful a country is Australia. We have our problems, we have our faults, we have our issues. There's no doubt about that. When I see things like that, I'm just very thankful for the wonderful country we live in.
This take by the PM has drawn criticism from NT Senator Melindiri McCarthy.
The Prime Minister is using Martin Luther King in an inappropriate way. He was an incredible man, but fought through some incredibly difficult times in the history of the US and the world.
The senator urged Australians to understand that police brutality is not an issue limited to the United States.
Don't for a minute think that what's happening in the US isn't happening in Australia in terms of all those First Nations families who've lost loved ones through the prison system and in the custody system. We have very similar issues here in our country where First Nations people are dying in our prisons, are over-incarcerated in our prison system. There are outstanding court matters that are still occurring in our country with the deaths of Mr. Walker here in the Northern Territory, certainly Mr. Dungay in terms of New South Wales. There are so many similar cases in our country where First Nations families still want justice, still need answers as to what's going on.
That's a view shared by Cheryl Axelby of the Change the Record group.
I absolutely concur and agree with those comments.
The advocate says one simple look at the stats paints a bleak picture.
Our incarceration rates in particular have risen 130% since 1985, and also we are, our people are by far the most disproportionately impacted by mass incarceration in Australia, just like the many people and Black Americans are experiencing this situation over there in the States.
Cheryl Axelby from the group called Change the Record. Oliver Gordon with that report. You're listening to PM. We're on the radio, on the ABC Listen app, and you can get us via a podcast. I'm Linda Mottram. On Twitter, I'm at Linda Mottram. Ahead, a court ruling maintains that media companies can be held liable for defamatory Facebook comments on their news articles.
There's no way for them actually to stop the comments. Yes, they can put filters in. Yes, they can hide. There are things that they can do. But it's interesting. How can you be held liable for something that you can't 100% control?
The Prime Minister has refused to apologise to the almost 400,000 Australians caught up in the robo-debt fiasco, though he has said he has great regret about it. The government announced late Friday it would pay back $721 million in debts that were raised unlawfully under the automated scheme that began in 2015. In a separate announcement, some Centrelink recipients will also now need to start talking to a job agency. Rhett Burney reports.
The robo-debt scheme saw almost 500,000 Australians issued with computer-generated debt notices, totalling more than $720 million. Using data from the Tax Office and Centrelink, machines would decide who owed the government money, and it was up to those slapped with a notice to prove the computer was wrong. Now the government has conceded the program was a disaster and it'll pay back what it took.
And so these are difficult issues to manage, and I think the government has great regrets about any pain or injury that has been caused here. But as I said, those are issues that we're still working through and we're making it right, and I think that's the important step.
That's the Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, speaking at a press conference today. And while he says he's regretful, he refused to apologise. Ross Womersley is the CEO of the South Australian Council of Social Services.
It's alleged that there have been thousands of Australians that have been so distressed by robo-debt that they actually ended up taking their own lives. Now, that's an absolutely extraordinary situation. Beyond that, there are tens of thousands of other Australians who have received advice about robo-debts and have endured enormous distress.
But the Prime Minister says now is not the time to say sorry, especially with a class action against his government over the disastrous scheme underway.
We're still working through some legal procedures here right now. And so I think the time for those sorts of statements are at another time, not right now. We're in the middle of making this right.
ABC journalists were hearing whispers of a possible plan to can robo-debt on Thursday night when it's understood executives from the Human Services Department were summoned to a late-night meeting. But the government refused to confirm the tip-off. Instead, it waited till late Friday afternoon to announce it had abandoned the scheme and paid back so-called debtors. Ross Womersley again.
It's outrageous that it has taken this long for the government to reach this position.
Also announced over the weekend, plans to reinstate some so-called mutual obligations for some Centrelink recipients. From June 9, those on JobSeeker will need to meet with a job agency, either over the phone or online. And it's expected that in the not-too-distant future, some will be sent back to work for the dole. Tony Simcotta is 60 years old and on JobSeeker. He volunteers at a local charity store in country Victoria as part of his mutual obligation to Centrelink. He says that suits him because it means he's not forced to apply for up to 25 jobs a month to get his payment.
I know that if I went for a job now, they'd look at me and look at my age and say, we'll put him down at the bottom of the list.
Tony Simcotta says jobs were already scarce in the region he lives in before the pandemic. Now, with so many more people unemployed, he questions the value of Centrelink forcing those nearing retirement age to apply for jobs, especially with so many younger people now in the job market.
No one's going to hire a 55 or 60 year of age, a 60 year old man or woman when they know they're only going to be there for a few more, 4 or 5 years at the most. Why would you do that? It's a disaster. I think it's going to be very hard. There'll be a lot of people that won't be able to get their job back to start with.
Victorian man Tony Sincotta with our reporter Rhett Burney. And if you need help for yourself or anyone you know who's struggling, Lifeline is a service you can call. The number is 13 11 14. A former Catholic primary school principal who blew the whistle on a paedophile priest in the 1980s is to sue the Catholic Archdiocese of Melbourne for compensation. The Child Sexual Abuse Royal Commission heard Graham Sleeman repeatedly tried to get the church to remove Father Peter Searson from his position as parish priest. Nothing was done for more than a decade. And when Mr. Sleeman resigned from his job in protest, he never worked in education again. Samantha Donovan has the story.
His attempts to protect his school community from a violent paedophile priest in the 1980s have taken their toll on Graham Sleeman.
I contemplated suicide many times, particularly during the 90s. Still plays on my mind. Could I have done more? Should I have done more? What happens if I had have stayed there?
The case of the paedophile priest and the school principal was examined by the Child Sexual Abuse Royal Commission. It found that the Catholic Archbishop of Melbourne at the time, Frank Little, had failed to protect the children of the parish and the Holy Family School. From 1984 to 97, Father Peter Searson was the parish priest at Doveton in Melbourne's southeast. He lived on the primary school grounds, and the commission heard he carried a gun, had children sit between his knees during confession, showed them a dead body in a coffin and killed a cat in front of them. In 1985, Graham Sleeman's fears Searson was abusing children were confirmed when a little girl ran screaming from the confessional. But officials from the Catholic Education Office and the Catholic Archdiocese of Melbourne wouldn't act on Mr. Sleeman's complaints without evidence. In 1986, he thought offering his resignation would force the church and the Catholic Education Office to remove Searson. He resigned, but the parish priest stayed on.
The Archdiocese supported Searson and they failed to support me. And as I usually say to people, they'd rather support the paedophile priest and the perpetrator than look after the person who was trying to protect the children.
The Royal Commission was satisfied that Graham Sleeman resigned in frustration because of the inaction of the Archdiocese in relation to Searson. It said the effect of that inaction was that the Archdiocese supported Searson and did not support Graham Sleeman. Mr. Sleeman never worked in education again. The Royal Commission heard evidence that Archbishop Frank Little took the unusual step of asking to be notified if Mr. Sleeman applied for any jobs in the Catholic education system. Graham Sleeman.
Well, whether you want to call it blackballing or silencing me, that's what they were on about. But he continued to abuse children after I left.
Father Peter Searson was eventually removed from the parish in 1997 by the then Bishop George Pell. Searson had pleaded guilty to the physical assault of an altar boy in the late 90s, but he was never charged with any sexual offences against children and died in 2009. The Catholic Archdiocese of Melbourne has told PM that through the Catholic Education Office, it's made a compensation offer to Graham Sleeman. Mr. Sleeman has told us he considers it to be inadequate and he's now planning to sue the Archdiocese. Barrister David O'Brien is a former Victorian MP who sat on the state's parliamentary committee which investigated institutional child sexual abuse and reported in 2013. He's acting for Graham Sleeman.
The church ought to have taken the leadership position to have embraced the example of Graham Sleeman.
They need to readdress what they've done and look after the principle so that in the future our whistleblowers and our good people are protected rather than paedophile priests.
Julie Stewart was the little girl who ran screaming from Father Searson and the confessional in 1985. She's backing Graham Sleeman's claim for compensation.
He's lost so much in his life, and not just financially, but he's just completely a broken man, and he just needs to be at peace, and he deserves that. You know, he would have had superannuation, security of income coming in that he just didn't get due to defending and speaking up and taking care of all us kids that the Catholic diocese never did. Yeah, he deserves absolutely everything.
In a statement to PM, the Catholic Archdiocese of Melbourne says through Catholic Education Melbourne, it undertook a new independent-led review in 2019 to look into Mr. Sleeman's request concerning his employment, and that Mr. Sleeman took part in that review process willingly. The recommendations from the independent review were fully accepted by the Archbishop, the Archdiocese says, and an ex gratia offer at the top end of the recommendation was made in February 2020. The Archdiocese says it hasn't yet heard back from Graeme Sleeman as to whether he wishes to accept that offer.
Samantha Donovan with that report. Australian media companies are familiar with juggling the country's tough defamation laws, trying to avoid being sued. But today they're facing a new challenge: how to avoid being sued for defamatory comments that readers make on news stories that are published on social media, after a New South Wales court ruling today. Felicity Ogilvie reports.
Images of Northern Territory teenager Dylan Voller strapped to a chair in youth detention with a hood on his head shocked the world and sparked a royal commission. His lawyer, Peter O'Brien, has been arguing that Dylan Voller has been facing injustice online, with allegedly defamatory comments made about him on Facebook. The comments were made by members of the public on news stories posted by the Sydney Morning Herald, The Australian, The Centralian Advocate, Sky News Australia, and The Bolt Report.
Well, obviously, we're satisfied with the ruling. The court found that because media companies create Facebook pages and basically encourage and facilitate the making of comments that may well be defamatory, that they are responsible for the content therein.
Social media strategist Meg Coffey says the media is in a difficult position.
There's no way for them actually to stop the comments. Yes, they can put filters in. Yes, they can hide. There are things that they can do. But it's interesting. How can you be held liable for something that you can't 100% control?
What do you think this shows about the way traditional media who have been using social media to publish may or may not change how they publish news in the future?
I think it'll definitely change. I think that's going to make them take pause about what they put out there, especially with what the ruling's saying, that, you know, they're inviting comments by publishing.
Dylan Voller's lawyer, Peter O'Brien, says media companies have the ability to moderate Facebook comments.
Their ability to do it is, of course, subject to their preparedness to pay for it, and that's the problem.
And why is it that you took legal action against the media companies rather than the social media platform Facebook?
Well, Facebook is an organisation that has its offices in the United States of America. So even if we were successful in getting judgment as against Facebook, it would be impossible to enforce judgment. Most importantly, of course, though, we felt that the newspaper was the appropriate publisher.
In a statement, News Corp Australia, Nine and the Australian News Channel said the appeal court has shown that Australian defamation law is completely out of step with the realities of publishing in the digital age and how Australians consume news and information. The media companies are now considering taking the appeal to the High Court. The president of the Australian Journalists Union, known as the MEAA, Marcus Strom, says the judgment is going to affect all newsrooms.
That's going to send chills through newsrooms. It's going to make newsrooms question whether they can resource the moderating of those Facebook comments. So it's going to create a difficult period for newsrooms and how they use Facebook.
A media law expert from the University of Western Australia, Michael Douglas, says the ruling will upset the press.
So it means that media companies either need to dedicate far more resources to content moderation, or they need to find some way to disseminate their content without defamatory comments being made in the process.
Digital disruption has seen hundreds of jobs go in the Australian media, so hiring more people to moderate Facebook comments is an unlikely prospect.
Felicity Ogilvie with that report. I'm Linda Mottram. That is PM for today. You can always find us at the ABC Listen app and wherever you get your podcasts. That's where you should subscribe and leave us a review too. AM and The World Today are also there, so subscribe to them and leave them a review as well. Talk to you next time.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.
Hi, I'm Stephen Smiley.
And I'm Ange Lavoie-Pierre, and we're from the ABC's daily news podcast, The Signal.
The fury of Americans over the death in police custody of black man George Floyd is continuing to fuel uprisings on a scale not seen in a generation, with riots in cities across the United States. So is America permanently broken?
Today on The Signal, we're looking into the case that provoked all the anger. We ask what we know about George Floyd's final minutes and hear from a historian about whether there's any prospect the cycle of deaths, violence and civil unrest will end. Look for The Signal on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.